The City Club of Boise is a nonpartisan forum dedicated to free speech and the open exchange of ideas on issues critical to the Intermountain Northwest. Its motto is, things happen when people start talking. You can find information regarding forums, salons, and tours at cityclubofboise.org. The premier sponsor for the City Club is Northwest Nazarene University and the NNU School of Business. Programs are also made possible in part by a grant from the Idaho Humanities Council, the state-based affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Forum series sponsors are AARP Idaho, Bank of Idaho, Echelon Group, Micron, and St. Luke's Health System. The moderator for today's forum is Bill Russell.
Welcome to today's City Club Forum on the Federal Reserve System. I'm Bill Russell. I'm a City Club board member and the forum chair and moderator for today's forum. I would like to welcome our radio listeners to today's forum. Radio listeners, join us over Boise State's public radio on KBSX 91.5 FM and its affiliates throughout southern Idaho and northern Nevada. I would particularly like to thank Zions Bank for its support for today's forum. I would also like to thank our media sponsors, without whom we cannot do this, 670 KBOI Radio, Boise State Public Radio, the Idaho Statesman, Idaho Public Television, and Pepper Shock Media. And finally, I would like to thank our university partners, the University of Idaho, Boise State University, and Northwest Nazarene University. I want to do just a quick word of warning about your questions and what Mr. Oppenheimer is going to talk about here today. Given his position with the Federal Reserve System, he is prohibited from talking about some subjects. So please excuse me if I get a question from you and I look at it and I think that's something that he can't answer. I will probably not ask it. So if that happens, I apologize in advance. We're trying to protect his job and his responsibilities. And if I miss something, I'm sure he'll tell us if he can't talk about something. But there are some points of protocol in the job he serves that we're going to have to observe. Every day, including yesterday and today, news stories address the Federal Reserve System, yet many people know very little about the Fed. Last January, Skip Oppenheimer was appointed to the board of directors of the Federal Reserve Bank of San Francisco. Mr. Oppenheimer will describe his experience with regard to the operations, function, and purposes of the Federal Reserve Bank system. He will describe his experiences and understandings of the various activities of the Federal Reserve. Let me take a moment to introduce Skip. Skip is currently the chairman and CEO of Oppenheimer Companies and president of Oppenheimer Development Company. Skip graduated from the Harvard Graduate School of Business Administration with an MBA in 1972. Now, let me stop here for a minute because I just need, before I finish to the end of this part of his qualifications, I need you all to know that in college I had 16 credit hours of D in French. I'm just warning you before we get to the end, okay? He graduated from the University of Idaho with a BA in history in 1968, and he received a degree. This isn't French. A degree elementaire in 1967 from the Sorbonne at the University of Paris in France. He resides in Boise with his wife, Esther, who is with us today. I am proud to say that Esther is an NNU alumni. It actually was NNC back there, same time my wife was there. So we're happy to have Esther with us here today. They have two sons, Joshua, a graduate of the College of Idaho, and Lesley University, and an elementary school teacher in Boise, and Matthew, a graduate of Dartmouth College and Harvard Graduate School of Business. Skip also serves as a member of the Boy Scouts of America National Executive Board. He's a board member of the St. Luke's Hospital System. Thanks, St. Luke's, for being here. Board member of the Idaho Nature Conservancy and founding chair and director of Idaho Business for Education, one of the most influential forces in education in Idaho today. So with that, and with no further ado, Skip, it's all yours.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Bill. And thank you very much, and I appreciate the opportunity to be here. I had no idea there would be this much interest in the Federal Reserve, but it's kind of a nice indicator. There's a lot of very familiar faces. Let me start out speaking of familiar faces and just, as Bill did, just acknowledge my wife, Esther, We've been married for 45 years. We've actually known each other for 55 years, I think. So, Esther, thanks for being here. As I was going around just saying hi to a few people, I ran into John Miller, who also asked me to please acknowledge his table. And probably the importance of healthcare in our economy and to all of us as individuals. So thanks really to everybody for being here today, and hopefully we'll have a good discussion. It is sort of convenient that the Fed met yesterday. They do seem to be a little more visible these days for all kinds of reasons. So I'm sure that's part of the reason that everybody's here. And I will tell you, just, you know, speaking personally, I had very little knowledge other than, I would say, at a fairly kind of 30,000-foot level myself as to what the Federal Reserve does. And I think a lot of us look at the Federal Reserve, we know it's important. There's, I think, a lot of respect at sort of a macro level for the Federal Reserve, I think, for what it does, but probably not a lot of information about, you know, what do these people do? And exactly. When I first got involved, I was asked to be on the Salt Lake City branch, and I'll explain a little more about how the Federal Reserve is organized. And there's been quite a number of people from Boise who have served on that branch. Park Price serves on it now. He's been involved for quite some time. Ed Dahlberg was on it. Barbara Wilson was on it. Pat McMurray. Jazz Krizelik is on it now. There's been quite a number of people. I'm trying to remember who else, but those are Brad Wiskirchen served on it. So there's been a lot of people from this area who have been involved at the branch level. And I was on that branch for about 3 years, and then was asked to run for a seat that came open on the San Francisco head office board. The head office board is made up of 9 people. 3 are bankers elected by the banks in the Western region. 3 are non-bankers elected by bankers in the Western region. And 3 are public members that are appointed by the Board of Governors. The seat that I ran for was a seat that was elected by bankers. And you basically, as I said to them when they said, would you run for this? I said, you know, I haven't run for anything since high school. And they said, well, you know, we actually the staff can't do a lot. They can give you a little bit of general guidance. But basically to run, you get in touch with various bankers and banking, you know, the head of the California Bankers Association, Oregon Bankers, Washington, Idaho, and so on, and then certain bankers. And part of the idea is you hope other people don't. It's a little easier election if nobody runs against you. Although, it's, as I said, looking at me, you know, straight in the eye, we can't assure you you'll win if you're unopposed. But anyway, I did run unopposed, got elected, and that's kind of how that process works. You know, one of the things that I think is good news that I don't think is probably any surprise, but it was even more, I don't know, more obvious, more sort of, in a way, profound, in a good way, is the people that, in my experience, and I've only been on the San Francisco board, as Bill said, since January, but the experience, because when you're on the branch board, you also do spend time at the San Francisco board and in the San Francisco office. And then you do spend time in D.C., and you spend time with each of the members of the Board of Governors and the staff there. You know, and a lot of people who work there, some do leave and, you know, probably make a lot of money and do that kind of stuff. But the number of people, which is a large number, who dedicate their career to the Federal Reserve is, I will tell you, just speaking personally, incredibly impressive. The dedication to what they do, the diligence, they are some of the smartest people I've met or been involved with, and just the seriousness by which they take the work they do and knowing the impact they make is really, it's, you know, for want of a better word, it's really inspiring. So that it's a great experience to be involved in. And I feel like, you know, you learn, like all these things we all do, you learn a lot in the process and hopefully contribute a little something back. So let's get into just a little bit about what does the Fed do, and many of you will know a lot of this, but let me just give you a quick kind of overview. The overall mission is to promote the safety, soundness, and stability of the financial system, probably in our recent history, never more profound than 2008. Where the Fed played an absolutely key role in keeping this country's economy alive, basically, at a probably as important a time as we've had since 29. The two goals of the Federal Reserve that are established by Congress, and you, I'm sure, heard of, is called the dual mandate. And that's basically to foster maximum employment. And that's been set at 5% unemployment. And I would say the Federal Reserve, along with a lot of other players, but as at least one of its priorities, to the extent that it's been a key part of this, maximum employment of 5%, we've really, you know, outperformed. Today we're at, you know, roughly 3.9% nationally. Idaho's at like 2.6, I think. Boise's around a little over 2. So as far as performance around that part of the dual mandate, I think by almost every measure you'd argue that's going very well. The second piece of the dual mandate is stable prices, and that and keeping inflation at a stable level, and that has been pegged. The target rate's around 2%, and as again many of you know, we've been under that, and we've been under that fairly consistently for quite a number of years. In spite of a very strong economy for quite a number of years, since really, if you look at the tenure, the duration of this recovery, it's the longest in history of the economy. It's over 10 years. But on the other hand, it's been at about half the normal rate of growth, but it is the longest continuous recovery in recent history. So the basic history of the Federal Reserve, and I'll just touch on this, it was started back in 1913 by Woodrow Wilson. And there's two things that are somewhat unique when you look at central banks, and there are central banks obviously everywhere in the world. One is that this is a highly decentralized bank. And number two, it's very independent. And we'll talk a little more about that because that's been kind of a key, I think, discussion point here recently. And that decentralization allows for, and this is something, again, that any of us who've been involved in the Federal Reserve see this pretty front and center, they truly listen to the people on these boards and others who are on advisory committees to really try to understand what the heck is going on in the economy. And they try very hard to get a broad range of people on these boards, so they're covering a lot of different industry segments. But when you see ultimately things like the FOMC voting, it is grounded in some real reality testing. It's not just pure economic data and theory. It's how do you sensitize this by understanding from people that do this for a living what's really going on out there. And that's unique in terms of central banks around the country, I mean around the world. There's 12 districts, as Bill said. The San Francisco district, it's interesting because in 1913, when the Federal Reserve was founded and started, you can look at a map, and of the 12 districts, everything's sort of east of the Mississippi, basically, or around the Mississippi and east. There's really only 4 districts that are west, which is San Francisco, Kansas City, Dallas, and Minneapolis, if you consider Minneapolis west, so and Kansas City west. But the San Francisco the San Francisco district is the largest district. It's the most diverse of the 12 districts. It includes the nine western states and the Pacific territories. It covers almost 20% of the economy. It operates out of 6 different locations, San Francisco being the head office, and then 4 branches. There's a Seattle branch, Portland branch, Los Angeles branch in Salt Lake. And then there's a cash management office in Phoenix. But those are the four branches plus the cash office. It's led by Mary Daly, who just recently, are most people familiar with her story at all, or is it worth giving a little quick? It's a very interesting story. She, and this has been interesting with San Francisco as well. You know, the past two presidents of the San Francisco Fed, two presidents ago, was Janet Yellen. Janet grew up in the San Francisco Fed, ultimately went on to become, of course, the chair of the Board of Governors. The next chair or president was John Williams. John spent quite a bit of time in Boise. I got to know him quite well. We had meetings with Crapo, different people. He came here quite a bit. And John was the president for quite a number of years. He just recently, within the last year, I think, was elected president of the New York Fed. The New York Fed arguably is maybe the single most important district, because that president is a permanent voting member of the Federal Open Market Committee, where the ultimate final decisions are made on interest rates. It's where, of course, Wall Street is. It's got a lot. So John moving from San Francisco to the New York Fed, he's also the vice chair of the FOMC, the New York Fed president. So arguably that's the most important. You could argue, not totally objective, that San Francisco, I would say, is right up there in rankings after New York because of just the amount of the economy that's covered by this district. So when John became the president of the New York Fed, there were about 100 applicants. The board of the San Francisco Fed, this was right before I came on, handles the search. Each of the boards select their own president. It's approved by the Board of Governors. Technically it is voted on by the Board of Governors, but they do the search and make the recommendation. So Mary Daly, and she's been here a lot. She loves Idaho, and she's doing some stuff with Idaho Business for Education with Rod and Carolyn and that group, which I'll touch on maybe in the questions. So Mary, John, you know, very traditional. Janet, very traditional. Economist, all the best schools, all that kind of stuff. Mary dropped out of high school, abandoned by her family when she was like 16, Kansas City. Ends up with somebody influencing her, said, you know, you seem kind of smart. You ought to get at least a GED. She said, well, yeah, what would I do with a GED? She said, well, you know, it might help you do something more than you're doing now. I think she was working like as a waitress. So she gets a GED. She ultimately, somebody again influences her to go to, I can't remember where, so I think maybe a college in Kansas City. She gets a bachelor's. She finds she's good at economics. She ends up getting a master's, goes to Syracuse, gets her PhD, starts out at the most junior position at the Fed in San Francisco, ultimately rises to the position of chief economist, goes through the search process, and is named the president. Part of her idea, we can talk more about this in the Q&A too, is how does the Federal Reserve do a better job of taking all this incredible data, all these great resources, really, and fabulous people, and apply it in a little more tangible way to help further those goals, the dual mandates that the Federal Reserve has been given by Congress. And one of those, as I said, is maximum employment. What are some things that the Fed could do to help further that? What better part of that than education? They're doing some work here with, as I said, with IBE and Rod and Carolyn around education. It turns out that the woman who runs the education part of the Federal Reserve of San Francisco lives in Boise and commutes to San Francisco. She's from Parma, Idaho. So she's got an affinity here. Mary's been here a couple of times and is coming back, I think, in October, I believe. Maybe not. but she sees Idaho as kind of a little laboratory for this idea of, at least around education, you know, helping take data that shows how important going on to some form of post-secondary education is. And it's the kind of thing that employers and maybe convening employees could maybe use more effectively to further the idea of education's importance in this part of the country, the Western region. So that's just one example. She is an amazing person. So, Bill, I don't know how much more. I mean, I can get into a little more, if you'd like, about monetary and some of that kind of stuff, or we can open it up to questions.
Let's go to questions, and then we can maybe you can extend some of the answers during the question time.
Sure.
We have got, at this point, about 36 questions. The single word that occurs on your cards most frequently is the word Trump. This is not a forum about Trump, so we won't be asking those questions. One other thing I want to caution you again, I just so you don't waste your time, when I get a question that says, you know, I'm 45 years old, how much should I worry about the 3-year yield curve? That's not a question we're going to put to Skip in this context. So, and then the one other caveat I have is this is not going to become a debate between two economics professors, because probably neither one of you are. So there are a lot of questions that want to debate the economic theory, and I really want Skip to focus on the system and what the system does and how it does it. So let me start with a question that is maybe a little sharp, but I thought it was a fair question. What percentage of Federal Reserve directors are female and minority? What is the Fed doing to increase these numbers and to encourage stellar leaders in their 30s or 40s?
Yeah, that's a really good question. There is a real effort, and Mary particularly, I'd say, is at the forefront of that kind of thinking, I mean, and the importance of diversity. Gender... kind of economic, sexual preference. She's really is a leader nationally in that as it relates to the Fed. So I think we're on the right track. I don't know the exact percentage. I know that if you take Salt Lake and San Francisco, those are the two I'm most familiar with. Pat Richards, who's the present CEO of Select Health, many of you are familiar with them. She's the chairman of the Salt Lake board. The other members, there's a guy, Chip Childs, who's incredible. He's the CEO of SkyWest. Tom Corrick from Boise, CEO of Boise Cascade. You know, Peter Metcalf. I'd say that, you know, when you look around at Peter is the chief executive officer emeritus of Black Diamond. If I look at the Salt Lake Center City Board, I'd say there's a little ways to go because Pat's the only woman. If I look at and really not a lot of ethnic diversity, if I look at the San Francisco board, the chairman of that one is Barry Meyer, who was the CEO, he's just retired, of Warner Brothers. Rosemary Turner is the deputy chair. She was a senior executive at UPS, the UPS, United Parcel Service. She's a minority. David White is the national executive director of one of the largest unions in the country, mostly around entertainment. He's African American. Tamara Lundgren is the president chief executive officer of Schnitzer Steel, Portland. I think there's still a lot of work to be done, but it's a really good question. I will just tell you, nobody's stronger in that kind of direction in terms of its importance and priority than Mary. So I think you'll see more and more of that diversity, but it's got a ways to go. It's not, I wouldn't say it's bad, but it's got a ways to go, I think, is a fair answer.
And I like this question. Why do the various federal chairmen always speak in such cryptic language when discussing interest rates or other matters?
I got the same question. That's one of the challenges, I think, anybody who's had any kind of experience with economics. It is a challenge to how do you make it understandable. I'm not totally objective, but slightly biased. But, again, I think Mary is so grounded in kind of what people like all of us think. She's very good at that. And Rod, I don't know how you feel, and Carolyn, but I know you both have had quite a bit of time with her. I think that's a fair statement. I think Jay Powell also, he's unique in that he's the chair of the Board of Governors, but he's not an economist by background. He's a lawyer, which is one strike against him as far as making things understandable and simple.
As long as lawyers are billing people, the world is good.
Yeah, sorry, Bill. Yeah. But he's very good also, I think, at setting a certain tone that is trying to be understandable. I mean, it's a very challenging position. And one of the things that I think Jay does very well is listens to people on the board. He listens to his economists, and he asks all the right questions. He's very insightful, but he's not an economist. I think in some ways, maybe not being an economist in terms of that question helps, because you've got a little different sort of perspective, insight, background. But I think there is an attempt, again, to, I don't know what the right word is, but sort of humanize and make more understandable the work that the Federal Reserve does, so that it becomes more accessible, more useful, has more value to all of us that organization is here to serve. So it's a good question.
I'm going to change this question just a little bit from the way the audience member posed the question. I want you to take this as an example, please. Assume that one of your members, for example, was an advocate of returning to the gold standard or some rather extended theory of economics. It could be any number of things. The gold standard is a good one to talk about. What would the impact be on the operation of the board of a member who had that kind of an extended position?
Well, as I said, one of the things that they try to do, and I think do pretty well, is get a range of different kinds of points of view. Part of that's industry, but part of that is sort of perspective and opinion. One of the other things that's impressed me a lot about the Federal Reserve is this question of it being independent. In other words, if somebody has a particular political persuasion, I will tell you, in the, what, 3 years, 3.5 years I've been involved, I have never, literally once, either in meetings or even socially particularly, heard, definitely not in meetings, heard any discussion of a particular political point of view. It's literally all about the economy, what is the data showing us, what is all of our collective experience telling us, and then how does that affect the decisions that are in front of us. But if somebody wanted to bring up the gold standard, I think that would be just woven into the discussion. It hasn't been that kind of discussion. It's been more about where the economy's going, what are the indicators telling us, what is the data telling us, what does that mean as we look ahead. It's more of that kind of discussion. But there is a real grounding in independence, and sort of a, like we all know, I mean, overused word, but the cultural idea, the foundation of that body is grounded in the idea of independence. So there really is very little political discussion. Different economic theory would definitely come up and be discussed. I have never heard anybody bring up that particular point of view, but it would be discussed.
So this, I want to drill down a little bit on that. There are a couple of questions that I think help do that. This one is concerning the role of data versus intuition. How does personal experience influence Fed decisions, i.e. are decisions purely the result of analysis and data, or are they perhaps intuitive?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And, you know, what I was trying to say earlier was an awful lot of what ultimately goes into the final decisions at the FOMC. And the way the process works, the branches all vote on the let's just take the interest rate question, and we'll apply it to that, because that's probably the most visible. The branches all weigh in, and that branch vote goes to the district head office, so in this case, San Francisco. Though usually there's two or three very key questions that are being asked that will weave into a decision and vote on the interest rate. The San Francisco board then takes that information, and it's grounded in data. There's always presentations by the economists around certain of those key questions at each of the meetings, but then there's really a very rigorous discussion that is intuitive and it's not pure data. It's a sense of what people that are in, you know, aviation industry or in the construction industry or in real estate or in retail or in manufacturing have to weigh in. The people that do the economic work then kind of take that information and synthesize it. Ultimately, then there's a vote. Then that vote ultimately goes to the Board of Governors where the final vote is taken, and that's how it works. But I think one of the biggest surprises to me was how much there is around kind of what's really going on in the true business world of, you know, that influences those kinds of decisions rather than just pure data. So it's a great combination of kind of real world experiential information with economic data, and then where does that kind of lead the decisions that are being made by the Federal Reserve?
So this will go a little bit further along that line. What percentage of members are economists? How much debate or disagreement is there about economic theory or economic schools?
Okay, well, San Francisco, none of the board members are economists. All the staff virtually, I mean, they're all economists. And the president, Mary, I mean, everybody who works there virtually is an economist. But none of the board's economists. On the Board of Governors, a bunch of those people are economists. But as I said, the chair isn't. So it's a mix.
So let's talk for a minute about how the Federal Reserve is funded. And I know that we have the different banks around the country, but this question goes to how a budget is determined and who pays for the Federal Reserve.
Yeah.
And who decides how to allocate the funds that are in the budget of the bank.
Yeah. Well, this kind of ties back to the idea of independence. One of the basic tenets of it being independent is that it doesn't rely on any congressional appropriation. It generates through interest, basically interest revenue, all of its funding. And it has a gigantic surplus that it returns back every year to the Treasury. So the funding is all generated by, in effect, interest revenue and certain fees that allow it to basically be independent. It's things like interest on holdings of government securities, interest on loans that it makes to financial institutions, to banks, fees for some of the services that it performs. And again, most all the profits return back to the Treasury. So it's basically self-funded with a big surplus. The budgeting is done at each of the district levels as well as at the Board of Governor level in terms of how the budgets are put together. The functions, each of these decentralized districts, like San Francisco, really runs its own region. They do their own regulatory work for the banks in its region. They, in effect, manage the various transactional things that go on within its region. But there are certain things that each one of the districts does, which in effect is a national function. So like San Francisco would be the cash product office. It handles all the cash processing for the country. So there are certain prescribed activities that each of the districts do for the whole country. And that gains efficiency, so you're not duplicating a lot of those kinds of efforts. But anyway, the funding is all and budgeting is done in our case, San Francisco level. The overall budgeting for the system's done at the Board of Governors level.
So you said something that I think we probably ought to dig deeper into. We normally think about the Fed in terms of policy issues, yep. economics, those sorts of things. But the Federal Reserve System is also a functioning system logistically. It provides all sorts of services. You talked about services and the fees that are charged to banks for services. Could you take a minute and talk about, beyond policy, what things does the Federal Reserve do to keep our banking system as a whole going and alive?
Yeah.
I think a good example would be wire transfers, those kinds of things, some of the things that the Fed does.
Right. Well, there are really, I would say, four or five key functions. The one that we always think about is interest rates and monetary policy. And that's probably the most visible to all of us as the general public. It also supervises and regulates banks in different ways depending on the size of the bank, but particularly after 2008, as you all, I think everybody, we all kind of recognize, the larger banks in particular became much more highly regulated. The money center banks, that's all the Federal Reserve's work. There was some discussion about some of the smaller banks were also highly regulated. As you know, that's become more, relaxed to some extent on the smaller banks. There's been some changes over the last 10 years, obviously, in the regulatory kind of requirements, even of the larger banks. But that regulatory piece is a second part. They provide payment services between banks, without getting too into the weeds, because I can see people starting to nod off here. there's a lot of transactional work, the reserve requirements that banks have that the Fed pays interest on, and there's a lot of lending between banks. That's all done by the Federal Reserve. It acts basically as a checking account, in effect, for the Treasury. It pays and receives money that goes back to the Treasury. The other part that I think you'll see more of is sort of this community function. How does it have better impact, more impact around the parts of the country, around the whole country? And I think you'll see San Francisco kind of leading the way on that. And as I said before, how do you use all this great data, all this great information more effectively for all of us as consumers of that information to make better decisions in our own lives? Some of that kind of thing I think you'll see happen. And then also as business people, how do we use that? How do we get better information to all of us to make better decisions in whatever segment of the economy we're in? That's a movement that I think you'll see more of. So there's quite a bit of activity, some of which is more visible than others, that the Federal Reserve does.
Yeah, I think we tend to think of the policy sides, as you say, the monetary policy side, but there's a lot more. So let me try that same question from a slightly different perspective. What would happen if we didn't have the Fed, if the Fed stopped right now?
Yeah. Well, we could start with what the Fed doesn't do. Fiscal policy, it doesn't do. And what is fiscal policy? That's really tax policy and spending. So if you just had Congress and the executive branch basically running the fiscal side, which they do, they have control over spending and they have control over tax policy, then the question you'd ask yourself is where would we be and where's the balance when and if the country gets into trouble? And how do you maintain, things like hopefully low unemployment and stable pricing? Where would that happen if you didn't have a central bank? Most every country has a central bank for that very reason. How do you maintain hopefully low unemployment, stable pricing, and reasonable interest rates? And so I think if you didn't have a Federal Reserve, if you didn't have a central bank, you would have a real problem maintaining, I think, particularly the interest rate environment, inflation environment, and the unemployment environment. And you'd have the question of who regulates the banks. And there is this value, I think, to having a central bank that is independent of the executive or of Congress. And if you didn't have that, I think you'd see everything getting pretty, and not that this is there aren't attempts at this, but pretty politicized decisions around the economy. Whereas a central bank that is independent and decentralized has the opportunity, and I think this central bank has done a good job of this, of making decisions that are really in the best interest in their view, not always the right perfect decisions, but at least it's done in the view of what's best for this economy or the economy that we're all operating in, and how do we make the best decisions in the interest of the economy, not anything to do with politics. Again, what is the role of the Congress and the executive in a central bank, and in this case in the Federal Reserve? It was established by Congress and the executive, Woodrow Wilson, as I said. It does report to Congress on policy actions and finances, so there is a reporting. The Fed governors are confirmed by the Senate. So those are the things that do connect back. So it isn't like they're just off here doing anything they want, but there is those connections back, and those things are the touch points back. But by and large, it's independent, and I think we gain a lot as an economy by having that independent central bank, and particularly one that, again, uniquely is decentralized.
Let me ask a couple of technical questions, but I think they're interesting. Do the Fed banks hold U.S. debt?
The Fed banks do hold some U.S. debt, and they hold a lot of private debt. One of the things, again, not to get too into the weeds here, but that I think we've heard about, and it was in the news again yesterday, is quantitative easing. That was a method in the 2008 crises where basically interest rates were, the Fed funds rate was dropped to close to zero to 0.25%, and it stayed there for about 7 years. But also, there was a huge amount of debt that the Feds took on, that the Federal Reserve took on, over $4 trillion to push a lot of money into the economy during that crisis. And that's called quantitative easing. There was an effort to begin to reduce that over $4 trillion worth of debt. And that was just announced yesterday by the chairman, as that was going to stop a couple of months early. So we do have, I think it's around 3.7, 3.8 trillion still on the Federal Reserve balance sheet that's owed in the form of various kinds of government securities or often government-backed securities that is on the balance sheet. And, you know, before the 08 crisis, the debt level might have been 700 or 800 billion. It's now at just under $4 trillion, so it holds that debt. That's something for, you know, certainly a lot of discussion and concern about how to continue to work through that. Because the question comes up, if interest rates are too low and you have that much debt on the Fed balance sheet and you do have a major downturn, this question of where, you know, how do you create enough cushion so you have some place to go becomes a real issue. That was one of the reasons that the idea of reversing some of that quantitative easing was put into play. So it's a real balancing act. But the answer to the question is, yes, they do hold, and right now, a larger amount of debt than anything historically that the Fed's had.
So let's balance a debt question with an equity question. Who owns the Federal Reserve banks?
Well, it's basically owned by the government. I mean, it's a government entity. It's a government body, again, created by Congress, and it's a part of the government, but it's independent of the executive and independent of Congress, except for the ways I described.
Okay. This is a question that I was actually getting ready to ask you, but when you talk about the Fed being involved in governing the banks. What's the difference between what the Fed does and what the comptroller of the currency does? Because the COC has a role in bank regulation also, as I understand it.
Yeah. The Fed's role on the regulatory side is ultimately, I think, a bigger role than the controller of the currency has more to do with money supply, with certain kinds of more, I would say, technical things, whereas the regulatory policies that are sort of prescribed for banks to adhere to, and then the oversight of those banks is done by the Federal Reserve.
So I know this reaches long before your time, but I think it's an interesting question. And if you've got insight into it, it would be worth discussing. Please talk about what happened before the Fed was created with regard to all these issues, monetary policy, financial challenges, inflation, regulation.
Yeah, you know, honestly, so, I remember I was a young man in those days. You know, I can't pretend to be an expert on that. I don't know. I mean, I assume that some of the things that I mentioned, if you don't have a Federal Reserve, were probably some of the issues. This is not something I have any real sense for. I think, you know, we had all these states, basically, if you look at, like, if you ever go to San Francisco or Salt Lake, you got to go to the Federal Reserve and go through their money museum. But all the states had their own currencies. There was all kinds of, you know, valuation and hyperinflation and no inflation. Just, you know, if you went from one state to the next, how do you transact business? All these, it's kind of interesting to see, but there were literally currencies in every state. And there was no central sort of denomination. There was no common currency. And so doing business and transacting business was kind of a mess. But the economy was a lot smaller in those days. But to be honest, that's not something I've got a great background on. It's a good question.
I have some sympathy for the museum concept. When I asked my wife, who I adore, where the money went, she said, it's in the museum. So,
yeah.
By which I think she means her closet. Okay, let's talk about a little bit about the data that the Fed depends upon. Does the Fed have their own method of collecting data, or do they rely on the Department of Commerce?
Yeah, the Fed does, I think. Again, I'm not trying to paint a perfect picture because they're not perfect, but they've done a really good job of assimilating a lot of data. I mean, they get data everywhere. As I said, they get it from the business community that's more qualitative. They get it from the Bureau of Labor. They get it from Commerce. They get it from Treasury. They develop a lot of data themselves. If you go to actually, it's kind of interesting if you haven't done it, and if you still are interested after spending an hour on this today, but you can go to the Federal Reserve site, and you'll get a picture, if you haven't, of what kinds of data they're using and how they synthesize a lot of data from a whole lot of sources. But it's a real broad, really broad. I mean, they deal with a lot of trade associations. I would say one of the geniuses, in a way, of the Federal Reserve is their ability to collect and make sense out of. And back to the question of, you know, how do you put this into any kind of form that people can understand? If you go on that site, you'll see. I mean, they do a pretty good job of pulling together some amazing ranges of data from a lot of different sources. And again, some of it's very, very much quantitative, but a lot of it is qualitative. So I think they're kind of a model, I think, for how you do that. In a way, they're looked at in the world, I think, as a model. You know, as the world is changing, as in every way that we all know, every day, when you look at technology, when you look at everything from how money is processed to where's the use of money going, and what about Bitcoin or, you know, Libra or all these different alternative currencies going, or, you know, there's just so many different aspects to the velocity of change we all know is going on. And they're doing, they, they some of the people from San Francisco who have put together the processing of currency just won an award in Europe like 2 or 3 weeks ago for the technological advances. It was kind of a model for the rest of the world. So they're at the forefront of a lot of this, but there are a lot of issues that, from, alternative monetary systems to, there's just a lot of things going on out there. This is going to be interesting to watch. Cybersecurity that we're all concerned about. Fed's very much at the forefront of that and how you protect both all of our, us as businesses and healthcare institutions and universities, but also, how do they protect the monetary system of this country, which is right at the fore. One of our kids is involved in a business that's a money transfer remittance, like sending money home to your family in the Philippines. And he started about 7 or 8 years ago, and he said that when they turned the system on, the first month, 60% of the hits were all hacks, just testing the system. Well, that was a business that had about 12 people in it or something, but fortunately it was smart people, I guess, because it survived all that. But just picture what the Federal Reserve is dealing with, picture what banks are dealing with. And we all know, we're all dealing with this in our daily lives and in our organizations and businesses. So they're very much at the forefront of those kinds of things as well.
This question is this: how do communities engage the staff of the Federal Reserve? And I don't know whether the question is asking for speakers to come to events or the opportunity to share wisdom with the staff of the Federal Reserve.
Yeah. So. Well, first of all, one of the reasons we're all on these boards is to be kind of the eyes and ears back and forth. So if anybody has a need, you could talk to me, Park Price, who's on the Salt Lake Board, as I said, Jazz Krizelik, who just went on the Salt Lake Board, anybody who's involved. As I said, Jody Hoff, who's the head of the education whole effort at San Francisco, lives here. So one way is to just engage any of us. Another way is to get a hold of the people. It's on the website, the person that heads up the Salt Lake branch, because we're in that part of the region, and they're really responsive. If you need something, you get online and get their phone number and call them, they'll respond immediately, I think. So, and again, part of the idea is how do we connect better so people are really open to that idea. If there's speakers you need or information. The Fed's careful a little bit about speaking at, they don't want to speak at, if somebody's having a private, event for their company, they don't want to be criticized necessarily for going to XYZ real estate brokerage company and not to somebody else. But if it's an association or not-for-profit or city club, anything like that, I think they want to get more visible and a little less, what are these people doing, and kind of the black box. So I think the timing for any of that, if anybody who asks that question is interested, is really good.
I have two questions that are similar, but they're about different topics. So the question is this: does the Fed have a mandate to address income inequality, and does the Fed have a mandate to address housing affordability?
No, they don't have a mandate for those two things. Technically, the mandate is those two things that I mentioned: maximum employment, stable pricing. Having said that, in order to get to those two things, it's, if you look at affordable housing, if you look at income inequality, there's a much bigger challenge to both of those things. You're going to have a lot more unemployment over the long term. If you have income inequality, you're going to have issues relating to those dual mandates. So they're not going to be directly involved, but if there's a way they can assist, I think that's more the way they'll try to weigh in on that. As I mentioned, things like education, there's no mandate to help improve education and help get more people going on to some form of post-secondary ed, and that could be a one-year certificate, that could be a two-year associate, it could be a four-year or beyond degree. There's no mandate, but that's tied into their basically their overall those dual mandates. And to do that well, you can't be too narrow in your thinking. And I think they're very interested and engaged in helping address issues that can further those basic strategic goals that they have in front of them. If that makes sense.
Yeah, we'll take this one last question because I think it's kind of a good summary question. When regional Fed officials travel around their districts, make speeches, or write papers, what is the primary message they'd like the public to know?
That's a really good question. I think, number one, that this organization, or the Federal Reserve as a whole, and within it, the San Francisco district, is trying very hard to serve the people in this region in terms of how we do even a better job of employment, better informed decisions for all of us to make as consumers of information, and then ultimately, you know, our economic lives, I guess. And how do we continue to make a better and bigger impact and use all those resources most effectively? That's number one. Number two, how do we harness the information the other way? How do we make sure that we as a body are listening to what's really going on in this part of the country so that ultimately those decisions that we've talked about are made with the best amount of information? And it's not, as we've said, just looking at the data. So to the extent that they come to town, they speak, and you show up and provide input, I think that's an important thing. And they're going to be continuing to be out there talking to people, not just those that serve on the board. So I think the biggest message is, how do we continue in a very rapidly moving world as a central bank to make the best decisions we can to further that dual mandate that's in front of that organization? And by getting out and making sure that organization is listening, I think that's part of what I think they'd like to make sure is resonating out in this part of the country. And I guess the other thing is, back to that question of how do we connect, if there's things that you think that, and go on that website, but if there are things that you think you can benefit from, let somebody know. I mean, either, as I said, the Salt Lake branch, any of us that are serving on any of these boards, let us know what we can do to help you to either get better informed for your organization, your endeavors. Let us know. I think that would be the other kind of message that would be out there. How do we make the best decisions by connecting with you all? And number two, what can we do to help you make better decisions?
Well, I was going to ask you what your takeaway would be from this, what you would like us to take away, but I think that last comment you made is probably it. And anything else?
No, I appreciate everybody being here. And again, anything any of us can do, those people I mentioned or any of us or anybody at Salt Lake Branch, that's what we're here to do. And I appreciate everybody showing up. Thanks.
You've been listening to the City Club of Boise, a forum about the Fed with guest Skip Oppenheimer, director of the Federal Reserve Bank of San Francisco. The next City Club forum features renowned swimmer and water quality expert Christopher Swain. He's going to pause swimming the length of the Boise River to speak on Wednesday, August 28th at noon at the Grove Hotel. Find more on that event at cityclubofboise.org. Connect on Facebook and Twitter by searching for City Club of Boise.